Let me just say a word or two before we get started. I recently received a copy of a wonderful DVD made by some young filmmakers about a magazine that was an international literary magazine centered in both New York City and Mexico City in the 60s. It was called El Corno Emplumado. And since I was part of it, they put some footage of still photographs of me collaged together from the 60s in it, and a little bit of me talking. And so what you're going to see is about 7 minutes of this DVD, which will give you a little sense of what I looked like, if nothing else, in the 60s. And the first person you'll hear talking is Ted Enslin. He's a poet who lives in Maine and was in New York in the 60s also. Then the next poet you'll see is Jerome Rothenberg, also a New York poet and who was my first publisher. And then I think you'll see a little snippet of Clayton Eshelman.
One evening a week when I could read every new poem I wrote, I became very friendly with who and I am. And one day he was a very early issue of El Coronado, and he said, well, I think you might be interested in this. And I was, so I got in touch with the bank. I thought it was a very interesting magazine because it had a tremendous number of directions in which it went. It brought things from many sources. And at that time, certainly, I don't think that most of us here were tremendously aware of what was going on in Latin America.
That's where we're going to stop. Okay. I went to Berkeley and was there from 1956 to 60, which is when I became serious about poetry. I think of that time as a time of the three Jacks. I was lucky enough to be chosen to go to read at the new San Francisco Poetry Center along with four other Berkeley poets in the late 50s. And at that reading, there was the poet that I didn't know anything about, but whom we all are fascinated by now, Jack Spicer. In the audience. I didn't know how perverse he was then. To me, it just seemed perhaps natural or charming that he booed all the male poets and clapped and stamped and whistled and applauded for me. I just thought that meant I was better than they were. Whatever it was. It was like being crowned, and I think from then on I knew that I was dubbed a poet. And that was important to me because up until that point, I'd been practicing the piano about 5 hours a day and having fantasies in that direction. The other two Jacks, one was Jack Anderson, who came as a graduate student and later became one of the notable dance critics for the New York Times, still writes beautiful surrealist poetry. And the other was Jack Gilbert, who was living in San Francisco at the time. And I think of, he came over to Berkeley one afternoon and we spent an entire afternoon talking about poetry. And that was the first time that had ever happened to me. And I guess I saw the possibilities of the world then. Another part of that scene was a wonderful Scotch woman, Helen Adam, who had moved to San Francisco. And she is the one, I think, who introduced all of us to the idea of the tarot cards as being an exciting medium for poetry, obviously channeling this through the more academic Yeats, who had been involved in such things. And the first poem I'd like to read for you is a poem I wrote right after I came to New York City and was thinking about my childhood growing up in Southern California. And found myself using imagery from the tarot deck. When I was a little girl, I lived in Orange County in an orange grove. And since I lived, my father was in the Navy, so I lived only with my mother and my sister, but they were three men who came to our house all the time. One was the milkman from the Pellissier Dairy, who came carrying his glass bottles of milk with cream on top. And the and another was the iceman, who came with his giant forceps and the 40 pounds of ice that fit in the top of our icebox. And the third one was the man who drove the bakery truck, the Helms Bakery. I suppose in retrospect, I loved calling him a helmsman because that brought up some of my mythology of my father, the sailor. The image from the tarot deck in here is the Nine of Swords, which in the deck that I like shows a man lying flat with nine swords pointing down at him. The Helms Bakery Man. The helmsman came in a yellow truck with a hard-shelled top like a beetle. Sometimes when I am in bed at night, I remember his donuts and fresh bread, white-sacked, sliding out in the smooth wooden tray. I sleep under a quilt patched with roses and signs of the zodiac. Nine swords hang over my bed. In the chest beneath me are bones. Each sword has cut some part of me, and I cling to the sword, keeping close the memory of an eye or an arm or a heart. Sometimes I wake up at night. Saturn glows like a ruby. Outside around me it is dark, but I hear the flutter of enormous wings. It's a hard life with bones under you and swords over your head, but it is everyone's life. At night, under the blanket of the zodiac, I hear a little toot, see the yellow truck come down my old street, and there he is, the helmsman, asking what I want today as I hand him my nickel. A bun, I say, and he gives me one with the moon in white icing decorating the top. I've talked a lot over the years about creating a personal mythology. In some ways, it's a very simple thing. You take your autobiography and look at your life and try to find the patterns and the archetypes that are there. I know that in my poems, I am either very young or very old. I'm never in the middle. And I suppose that's been one of my problems in life, never being able to be moderate middle class or in the Midwest. This poem that I'm going to read next is typical of the poetry I was writing in both the 50s and the 60s, very influenced by French surrealism and also by the Spanish surrealism of Federico Garcia Lorca. This poem is called Apparitions Are Not Singular Occurrences. And I think that was all I could say. Apparitions are not singular occurrences. When I rode the zebra past your door wearing nothing but my diamonds, I expected to hear bells and see your face behind the thin curtains. But instead I saw you, a bird, wearing the mask of a bird, with all the curtains drawn and the lights blazing, death drinking cocktails with you. In your thin hand like the claw of a bird, because you are a bird, the drink reflected the light from my diamonds passing by. Your bird's foot like thin black threads of bone or metal staples has the resistance necessary to keep death at a pleasant distance, drinking his scotch and enjoying your company, as he seldom has a chance. The zebra hide against my bare legs is warm. The diamonds now warm on my neck, on my fingers, my feet, my ears. How death looks at them all, and my body, and the old man desires them all. I rode by your windows, hoping you would see me and want me, not knowing you already had a guest. The diamonds I put on for you, the clothes I took off, and my zebra, did you see his eyes just slightly narrow as we came by? Not knowing you would wear your bird mask, I let you see my face. Not knowing death would be there, I rode by. And death and I see each other now so often, I have even thought of becoming a trapeze artist so that I might swing on the bar away from him. So far up, he'd never reach me. But instead, I see him more and more with all my friends drinking, talking, and always keeping his elderly eyes on me. And you watching me ride by on my zebra and dressed only in my diamonds were my one last hope. But even you, wearing the mask of a bird, invited him to have a drink and left the curtains drawn for him, sharing something you had no right to share. That poem was probably written with one man in mind, a poet named George Stanley, who had been a friend and lover of Jack Spicer's, though I never knew him in San Francisco when I was at Berkeley. But when George moved to New York, I guess Jack gave him my name, and George Stanley and I became good friends, went to a lot of readings and so forth together. He, I guess, was one of those men who liked to flirt with the idea of women but wasn't really interested in them. And so that was a disappointment. When I came to New York, I was living with avant-garde composer Lamont Young. And as he got more involved in his activities and I and mine, we drew apart. And we split up because I ran off with another friend, an artist, the avant-garde minimalist sculptor, Robert Morris. And before Bob had his loft on Church Street, where we lived for a while, we were in an apartment on the Lower East Side, and he had a loft down near the Fulton Street Fish Market in the Battery area of the city. And one day I was, I guess I had gone by to pick him up so that we could go somewhere. And I was sitting there in the studio passing the time. It was a great building. Mark DeSouvereau, the sculptor who had been at Berkeley when I was there, had a studio there where he was making his giant timbered things. And an artist whom I had never heard of at the time, although she became quite well known later, a South American woman who called herself Marisol, had a studio right across from Bob's. And I guess the day that I was sitting there waiting and scribbling, as I was always scribbling poems, I looked out the door and I saw into Marisol's studio, and this may be an apocryphal memory, but this is what I think I saw. I think I saw that now rather famous sculpture of hers, a flat wooden sculpture of George Washington sitting on his horse, riding his horse. Probably because George Stanley was on my mind, the name George had a little resonance for me. And I started writing my first series of poems, the series that I call the George Washington Poems, in which I try to put together my sense of the of being an American and my sense of what politics are, which are always personal for me. And so I'm going to read you the very first poem that I wrote, and it's simply called George Washington. You'll see in it my fascination for the epistolary world, the love of letters, and my early sense that the way a poem works best is as if it's coming to you like a letter from a lover or a best friend that you've been waiting for, and you want to open it up and read it. George Washington. Wearing a green silk dress, I drove to California with a giraffe who looked like George Washington. The roads were long and covered with ivory boxes. We stopped at a filling station for gas and found that the next 100 miles of road would be dangerous. I left notes for you in every ivory box we passed. The gold clasps did not open properly. I wrote letters to you and fastened them with gold clasps, but my green dress wore out long before I reached California. The giraffe abandoned me at the first zoo. I kept calling information and asking for George Washington, but his phone service had been shut off in Washington, New York, LA, and Palm Beach. We can't connect you with the new president, said the operator. It won't do any good, I answered. I must reach George Washington. No one else will do. So I left more notes for you in the ivory boxes. I kept saying, let me know where you are, George. I traveled all the roads in the country. I left notes everywhere. I sent you letters with gold catches unclasped. I telephoned every place I could think of. My giraffe left me after finding a zoo. My green silk dress wore out. I have no clothes. Please tell me what I'm doing riding over the same dangerous 100 miles every day, leaving letters in every ivory box. They all bear your name, George. Please tell me what I'm doing, why. Sometimes I do remember reading in the paper over 200 years ago that you died. I must know you're dead by now. Please tell me what I'm doing, George Washington. Please tell me for my own good. Perhaps it was going down to the area where the Fulton Street Fish Market was, although I have to say I never penetrated that wonderful institution when I was there. It was never open. It only opened at dawn for the restaurateurs. But being near the water, I suppose, reminded me of my second favorite landscape, the ocean. my first being the desert, of course. And this poem, which I'm going to read from the early 60s, is called The Few Silver Scales. I probably wrote it again while I was sitting there doodling in Bob Morris's studio. I have all my life been fascinated with great craftsmanship, great skill. It has always been my lament that I am not a great craftsman at anything. But it's Wallace Stevens I love, even if people call me a daughter of William Carlos Williams. And in this poem, in one of the early poems, where I talk about that fascination for craft. The Few Silver Scales. The feeling comes, the critics say, spontaneously. A gull swooping to the water, grabbing food, and skill not contrived, but gracing the dipping wings. I know what they say, have never found it so. How stiff my wings extend, creaking like a boat moored, rocking in the waves, and how the morsel slips away into the water, sliding fish. Only a few silver scales in my beak after I dive to catch it. The feeling comes lurching me, and I must grab it as best I can. How lucky I feel with a few silver scales dripping from my beak. This next poem is one of the few poems I've written that was ever published in the New Yorker. And not because I don't send them poems all the time. I've sort of given up. Once every 2 years now is enough for me. this poem was written and published at the end of the 60s in the New Yorker, and it also reflects that world of living with an artist in a loft and then visiting the many lofts of other painters and sculptors. Inside out, excuse me. I walked the purple carpet into your eye, carrying the silver butter server. But a truck rumbles by, leaving its black tire prints on my foot. And old images, the sound of banging screen doors on hot afternoons, and a fly buzzing over the Kool-Aid spilled on the sink, flicker as reflections on the metal surface. Come in, you said, inside your paintings, inside the blood factory, inside the old songs that line your hands, inside eyes that change like a snowflake every second, inside spinach leaves holding that one piece of gravel, inside the whiskers of a cat, inside your old hat, and most of all inside your mouth, where you grind the pigments with your teeth. Painting with a broken bottle on the floor and painting with an ostrich feather on the moon that rolls out of my mouth. You cannot let me walk inside you too long, inside the veins where my small feet touch bottom. You must reach inside and pull me out like a silver bullet from your arm. The phrase inside the blood factory from that poem became my next Doubleday collection. Sort of was also a point in time when I was beginning to move away from that kind of surrealism into perhaps more figurative and at the same time minimal poems. My very first collection of poems was a chapbook published by Jerome Rothenberg, whom you saw on the DVD, talking about how it might be easier for us to feel that we could get known in the coffee houses, and not just easy, but we didn't have access. None of us were academics, although all of us were moderately well-educated, and didn't feel that because you were well-educated, you should wind up as a college professor. In that respect, I have betrayed my Berkeley ideals. However, I did not betray my Berkeley ideal, which was that good artists never get graduate degrees. My highest degree is a bachelor's degree. So some of those pledges I made, I've stayed very true to. This first chapbook, which Rothenberg published, again, this is the kind of story that will make those of you who are young poets and feeling that you can't get published gnash your teeth in anger that you didn't live in the 60s. Because those of us who weren't part of the mainstream, which is a very small mainstream, actually, had access to all the little mimeographed magazines. I know Tim has been researching all of those. And we felt that if you got known in your little puddle, eventually somebody from the bigger puddle would want you. The first New Year's Eve of 1960-61, when I was in New York, I don't know what Lamont was doing. He was probably off with Yoko Ono planning some loft concert, but I accepted an invitation from George Stanley to go to a party which was held at Leroy Jones' loft. This is when Leroy Jones was still Leroy, not Amiri Baraka, and he was still married to Hetty Cohen, and they had a loft on 14th Street. And they were much more prosperous than the rest of us. I'm not quite sure why. Perhaps they came from middle-class families. But at any rate, they were prosperous enough to throw a big party. And I began to feel kind of sad wandering around that party with George flirting with all of his boyfriends and all the handsome men who were there. And at just the right moment, I ran into Howard Ant, the man who ran the readings at the 10th Street Coffee House. And Howard said, "Diane, would you like to go to another party?" Yes, I definitely did. We found another woman who actually was one of my roommates in Berkeley, Ruth Schmidt, who had come to live in New York. And Ruth and Howard and I went off to this party, which for me is historic, because at it, I met all the people who were my poetry crowd, the Deep Imagists, at that party. It was given by Armand Schwerner, and there I met Diane and Jerry Rothenberg, Robert and Jovi Kelly, David Anton and his then girlfriend, George Ikonamu and Rochelle Owens, and a bunch of other people. And as I was, I guess I was sort of a hit of the party because I was an outsider bringing the news from Berkeley and San Francisco and all the things that were going on in connection with the Beats there. And so at the end of the evening, as we were leaving, Jerry Rothenberg said to me, I'd already found out about his little press, Hawkswell Press, "Do you think you'd have a manuscript? Would you like to give it to me? Would you consider publishing at Hawkswell Press?" And so that's how I got my first chapbook. The title comes from a poem called "Coins and Coffins Under My Bed," and I'm going to read that. Here again, I'm working with myth, fairy tale, trying to talk about my secret or a shameful or taboo life in ways that weren't autobiographical or literal. Coins and Coffins Under My Bed. Three children dancing around an orange tree, not holding hands because the tree is too round and full, and there are only three of them. the spiders making their webs in the orange tree talk to the children. Do you want silver coins? Do you want silver cups? Do you remember our names? They ask. One little boy answers, I want silver rings. I want silver keys. I remember my own name. It is John. But the spiders are making their webs larger and larger. A yellow spider says, Do you hear us spinning? The sound is so loud it makes our legs vibrate. Do you know that David is dead and buried under this tree? Do you want silver coins to buy death away? Do you want silver cups to drink at your wedding? We spin our webs to spell your names, our names, dark names. Three children dancing around an orange tree, they are heavy with childhood. We want silver rings that link us together and silver keys to unlock your webs. And we all know our names. We are John. Quietly under the orange tree, David, who is dead and buried, settles down. The spiders walk over the earth like tightrope walkers, playing above the crowd, and I forget the coffin under my bed. Tell me, spiders, what I want to hear. Why, those children, all three of them, sing around the tree. They are heavy with rings, their bodies are made of bells, and tell me, what are your names, spiders? I will write your names on coins and throw them in the coffin under my bed. Tell me why my hands are empty of rings, yet heaviest of all, and my body like a bell doesn't ring. I have thousands of keys, keys on the doorstep, in my ears, under my pillow, in my clock, rooms full of keys, chests full, iron crates full. They unlock everything, and I hate them. Three children around an orange tree who know the answers to everything. Spiders who know more. Do you see the round orange tree with three children dancing around it? I'm trying to believe I haven't seen glinting through the leaves the hanged man caught by his key ring, hanged by the key, the sun catching it as he swings. And of course, that last image is another image from the tarot deck. About the time that I started moving out of my inside-out world of surrealism, I was beginning to do the one thing that I think made the feminist movement interested in me. Because I've always said I'm not a feminist because I'm not political, even though I wrote right from the standpoint of a woman. But I began to write poems that expressed a lot of anger. And this sort of fit in with my mythology too, because one of those iconic mythic figures for me was Beethoven. You know, I may have given up playing the piano so that I could write poetry, but I didn't give up music. And two of my composers, my two composers, were Chopin and Beethoven. And I loved the idea of Beethoven because he always seemed to me to represent strength and anger, probably because he was deaf. And what little I knew about his biography was that there wasn't much love in his life. So the poem I want to read now, chose between two, is called Love Letter, postmarked von Beethoven. It actually was published in my next book, the book that was known for my angry stance with the picture of me and a motorcycle on the cover, the motorcycle betrayal poems, and a dedication to all the men who've betrayed me in hopes they will fall off their motorcycles and break their necks. On the other hand, I'm sort of a pussycat when it comes to anger, and I never would have really made it as a serious political person, because I'm always trying to balance things out. Love letter postmarked von Beethoven. I am too angry to sleep beside you, you big loud symphony who fell asleep drunk. I try to count sheep and instead find myself counting the times I would like to shoot you in the back. Your large body with its mustaches that substitute for love, and its knowledge of motorcycle mechanics that substitutes for loving me. Why aren't you interested in my beautiful little engine? It needs a tune-up tonight, dirty with the sludge of anger, resentment, and the pistons all sticky, the valves afraid of the lapping you might do, the way you would clean me out of your life. I count the times your shoulders writhe and you topple over after I've shot you with my Thompson Contender, using the .38 caliber barrel or else the one they recommend for shooting rattlesnakes. I shoot you each time in that wide, dumb back, insensitive to me, glad for the mild recoil of the gun that relieves a little of my repressed anger. Each time I discharge a bullet into you. One for my father who deserted me and whom you masquerade as. Every night when you don't come home, or even telephone to give me an idea of when to expect you. The anguish of expectation in one's life and the hours when the mind won't work waiting for the sound of footsteps on the stairs, the key turning in the lock. Another bullet for my first lover, a boy of 18, but that was when I was 18 too, who betrayed me and would not marry me. You too, betrayer. You who will not give me your name as even a token of affection. Another bullet, and of course each time the heavy sound of your body falling over in work shoes, a lumber jacket, and a notebook in which you write down everything but reality. Another bullet for those men who said they loved me and followed other women into their silky bedrooms and kissed them behind curtains, who offered toasts to other women, making me feel ugly, undesirable, anger, fury, the desire to cry or shake you back to the way you used to love me, even wanted to, knowing that I have no recourse, that if I air my grievances, you'll only punish me more or tell me to leave. And yet, knowing that silent grievances will erode my brain, make pieces of my ability to love fall off like fingers from a leprosied hand, I shoot another bullet into your back trying to get to sleep, only wanting you to touch me with some gesture of affection. This bullet for the bad husband who would drink late in bars and not take me with him, talking and flirting with other women, and who would come home without a friendly word and sleep celibate next to my hungry body. A bullet for the hypocrites, a bullet for my brother who could not love me without guilt, a bullet for the man I love who never listened to me, a bullet for the men who run my country without consulting me, a bullet for the man who says I'm a fool to express anyone, to expect anyone to listen to me. A bullet for the man who wrote a love poem to me and a year later threw it away, saying it was a bad poem. If I were Beethoven, by now I'd have tried every dissonant chord. Were I a good marksman being paid to test this new Thompson contender, I'd have several dozen dead rattlers lying along this path already. Instead, I am ashamed of my anger at you whom I love, whom I ask for so much more than you want to give. A string quartet would be too difficult right now. Let us have the first movement of the Moonlight Sonata. I will try counting the notes instead of sheep. Among my friends who were important from that night at the New Year's Eve party were Robert Kelly and his then-wife, Joby, a librarian who worked for the Brooklyn Museum. And unfortunately for me, in the early 60s, Robert Kelly, who was the only one of us who was really erudite, a scholar, although also not with a PhD, and he was also academic in a way that none of the rest of us were. He was offered a job at Bard College, where he went up the Hudson, and he's been there ever since. Lucky Bard College, perfect place for an avant-garde poet to be. As a consequence, I used to take the train up and visit Robert and Joby many weekends over a period of a couple of years. And so I became friendly with lots of Bard College students. And every once in a while, one of them, usually a guy, would come knocking on my door in Manhattan and wanting to show me his poems and perhaps other things. And one of them is the person to whom I wrote this poem. Remember, I said that in my poems I'm either very young or very old. In this poem, I'm elderly, although I'm actually only 28. this yet another one of the Davids in my life. I seem to collect people by names. David came, and well, many of you in this audience have been my students. You know that I have always been extremely forthcoming in my criticism. And so I really raked him over the coals for this terrible manuscript he brought to show me. And then after he left, I felt sorry. I always feel sorry after I burn a bridge. So I wrote a poem called An Apology. And if I've ever insulted your poetry and you still want to like me, you might turn to this poem and read it sometime. An Apology. Past exchanges have left orbits of rain around my face, words used up as the empty shell of the beetle. I did not mean to insult you, but perhaps wanted to scorch you with that steamy tea kettle of my 2,700 years, to tell you youth shouldn't be humble as the tablecloth, but arrogant and fierce. We get toothless with age, should bite hard when we're young. To tell you not to follow masters whose egos are sponges. To tell you not that you had nothing to say, but that you need to pour it out at your own speed in an empty space where it will knock against you. I saw the dream of the tongue floating in a bowl of water as a desperate sacrifice. You giving up your own words. You giving up identity to float safely on display in another man's ocean. I saw everything that made me weep spools of rotten thread for my own disconnected life, drop cement trowels from my knees and broken clocks from my elbows. Wanting to discard the past, renege my own life, the pain of recognition and hate mingles with the identity. I apologize for lack of grace, for not passing you with a Zen stance. Elders should be lacquered in their place, and women commit their words to the dream code. Toads and shooting stars in the blood, icy milk pails, snow, oranges, diamonds, eyes to the ground. Women should be silently riding their zebras. So I'm bearing back to my nakedness and riding my zebra. I think that one of the things that's actually gotten me well through life, so that I don't have to get angry at things like our current political situation. I can just think about something else. Is that I've always had these very strong black and white views of things. And so I think of them as my prejudices, and I live with them because I think they show me how to live in a good way. One of my prejudices, and don't ask me where it came from, because truly I do not know, and I doubt if a psychiatrist could figure it out either, but I have always thought that people, but particularly men, who wear rings on their little fingers are fakes and phonies. They're superficial, they're amateurs, they don't know what they're doing, they're pretending to be something they're not. And, you know, it's useful to have these, well, so I don't have to talk to him, he has a ring on his little finger. Whatever. Or that's why he doesn't love me, he has a ring on his little finger. And you'll notice that I really always have been ringless. Twice in my life I've had rings, and they have always been disastrous and fortunately didn't last very long. But rings, of course, are traditionally symbols of power. And I wrote this poem in the late 60s when I had gone to the Guggenheim Museum to hear a poetry reading by a poet whom I loved then and I love now, Gary Snyder. And of course, those of you who know Gary Snyder and his work know that there's no way that you could call this guy who lives without plumbing and electricity, you know, a phony or someone who's superficial. This is a person who's always been involved with all the things that are genuine, sincere, all the things that the 60s were about. So I was backstage talking to someone, and imagine what I felt when I looked over and saw that Gary was wearing a ring on his little finger. Well, I knew I had to do something with that, so. Ringless. I cannot stand, oh, this is never my angry poems, right? I cannot stand the man who wears a ring on his little finger, a white peacock walking on the moon, and splinters of silver dust his body. But the great man, George Washington, cracked in half in my living room one day, and I saw he was made of marble with black veins. It does not justify the ring to say someone gave it to you and the little finger is the only one it will fit. It does not justify to say Cocteau wore one and still made the man burst silently through the mirror. Many beautiful poems have been made with rings worn on the little finger. That isn't the point. Flaubert had jasper, Lorca had jade, Dante had amber, and Browning had carnelian. George Washington had solid gold. Even Kelly once wore a scarab there. But I am telling you, I cannot stand the man who wears a ring on his little finger. He may indeed run the world, that does not make him any better in my needlepoint eyes. Why is a story? There were heaps of fish lying shimmering in the sun with red gashes still heaving, and the mouths of medieval lovers. There were gold and green glass balls bobbing in their nets on the waves. There were black-eyed men with hair all over their bodies. There were black-skirted women baking bread, and there were gallons and gallons of red wine. A girl spilled one drop of hot wax on her lover's neck as she glanced at his white teeth and thick arms. There were red and silver snakes coiling around the legs of the dancers. There was hot sun, and there was no talk. How do I reconcile these images with our cool president, George Washington, walking the streets? Every bone in my body is ivory and has the word America carved on it. But my head takes me away from furniture and pewter to the sun tugging at my nipples and trying to squeeze under my toes. The sun appeared in the shape of a man, and he had a ring made of sun around his little finger. It will burn up your hand, I said. But he made motions in the air and passed by. The moon appeared in the shape of a young Negro boy, and he had a ring made of dew around his little finger. "You'll lose it," I said. But he touched my face, not losing a drop, and passed away. Then I saw Alexander Hamilton, whom I loved, and he had a ring on his little finger, but he wouldn't touch me. And Lorca had rings around both little fingers, and suddenly everyone I knew appeared, and they all had rings on their little fingers, and I was the only one in the world left without any rings on any of my fingers whatsoever. And worst of all, there was George Washington walking down the Senate aisles with a ring on his little finger, managing the world, managing my world. That's what I mean. You wear a ring on your little finger and you manage my world. And I am ringless. Ringless. I cannot stand the man who wears a ring on his little finger. Not even if it is you. I'm going to read two more poems. The next one is another tarot card poem. And at the point when I started writing this poem, I was trying to think or find intuitively, since I had left the prosody of sonnets and traditional poetry behind, to find a way to put my sense of music into poetry. And one of the things I discovered was incantation chant, and so you'll see a version of my doing it in this poem. It's called The Empress Number 5. The Empress is a beautiful card in the tarot deck that represents, I think, women at their best, or the female spirit at its best. The Empress Number 5. She took the bone from her arm. This music frenzied the wild gazelles and the milk pigs running under the high arches of her feet and past her heavy black-budded breasts. Taking this instrument to file the words in her shawl, spilling out in disorder, honing each syllable till the screeching became a harmony, till the buzz became small on the smooth edge of a word. She set herself a simple task, but the music in her own arm bone was so loud, she set the thicket within her running. Arm bone, arm bone, arm bone, the arm bone sings, the arm bone sings, and the gazelles leap under her armpits, the small pigs snuffle and run past lips, the birds caw, caw. What noise as she only makes a word, commotion for every syllable. And I promised Tim Lane that I would read Blue Monday, which of course is also a poem in which I'm trying to figure out how to work with my own sense of being a musician who no longer has a keyboard except for the typewriter. Again, many of you who are my students know this poem. I often read it or talk about it in class. The title Blue Monday is the title of a famous blues song, and this poem is appropriately a song about lost love, being rejected by the men I love. The other model for this poem is one of the most musical poets I know of, even though I don't read Spanish, Federico Garcia Lorca. And I learned a lot about repetition from reading his poems in translation. Of course, Lorca was a very successful musician, and perhaps he was first a musician and then a poet, and you definitely feel it in his poems, so that's what I was trying to learn. Blue Monday. blue of the heaps of beads poured into her breasts and clacking together in her elbows. Blue of the silk that covers Lilytown at night. Blue of her teeth that bite cold toast and shatter on the streets. Blue of the dyed flower petals with gold stamens hanging like tongues over the fence of her dress. At the opera, opals clasped under her lips and the moon breaking over her head, a gush of blood-red lizards. Blue Monday, Monday at 3 o'clock and Monday at 5, Monday at 7:30 and Monday at 10 o'clock, Monday passed under the rippling California fountain, Monday alone, a shark in the cold blue water. You are dead, wound round like a paisley shawl. I cannot shake you out of the sheets. Your name is still wedged in every corner of the sofa. Monday is the first of the week, and I think of you all week. I beg Monday not to come, so that I will not think of you all week. You paint my body blue on the balcony in the soft, muddy night. You paint me with bat wings and the crystal, the crystal, the crystal, the crystal in your arm cuts away the night, folds back ebony whale skin, and my face, the blue of new rifles, and my neck, the blue of Egypt. And my breasts, the blue of sand, and my arms, bass blue, my stomach, arsenic. There is electricity dripping from me like cream. There is love dripping from me I cannot use like acacia or jacaranda, fallen blue and gold flowers crushed into the street. Love passed me in a blue business suit and fedora. His glass cane hollow and filled with sharks and whales. He wore black patent leather shoes and had a mustache. His hair was so black, it was almost blue. Love, I said. I beg your pardon, he said. Mr. Love, I said. I beg your pardon, he said, so I saw there was no use bothering him on the street. Love passed me on the street in a blue business suit. He was a banker, I could tell. So blue trains rush by in my sleep, blue herons fly overhead, blue paint cracks in my arteries and sends titanium floating into my bones, blue liquid pours down my poisoned throat, and blue veins ripple. It is blue. It is blue. Thank you. Since this is supposed to be about the 60s as well as poetry, if anybody wants to ask questions or make comments about the 60s and or how this relates, I'd be more than happy to field such questions. And I will talk into the mic. On the other hand, one of the reasons we hate Q&A is not just that people say, what inspires you to write and other stupid questions. but also, I think it puts a, I myself never have a question for a poet afterwards. I think it puts a terrible burden on all of you. And as I say, the only reason I'm suggesting it tonight is if the world that I'm talking about, which is so, so, so different from the one we all live in here in East Lansing, is something you want to talk about or ask about, I'd be more than happy. But that might be better done talking to me privately. I don't see any overwhelming questions.
Well, thank you very much, Diane. Thank you all for joining us. And if you have questions you'd like to ask Diane sort of in a private forum, I'm sure she'll stay for a few moments. We appreciate you coming, and I want to let you know that Blast from the Past, the exhibition that is surrounding you, continues through March 18th. And I just want to ask you all, if you would be so kind as to fill out our program evaluation, we would love that. Thanks for coming tonight.